So tonight I'm going to be talking about the second fetter, and I'm going to do an overview of all the fetters because I started this about 2 months ago, and I think you might have forgotten. And it's actually a really good timing because Laura talked about faith, and I wasn't able to be here, but I listened to her talk, and it was really a very well done talk. I think she covered the subject well. So I'm doing the about faith. So I'm doing doubt. I'm doing doubt in practice. And I'm sure we've all experienced some doubt about what we're doing. Are we doing it right? Is this the right path for me?
Doubt so, the teacher.
That too, and I will be going into that as well. He said doubt in the teacher. Yeah, that too. So let me go back to the beginning with the fetters. The reason I started looking into them, it was another list. I had memorized it, you know, as part of Dharma teacher training. You memorize list after list, and, you know, some of them are useful and some aren't. I didn't think too much about the fetters until I gave a talk on Nibbana, or Nirvana in Sanskrit, and asking, what is your goal for practice? And the Buddha had said the goal should be to completely awaken, to achieve what we're going to call Nibbana. And Sariputta, one of his chief monks, disciples, defined it as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. So just for a moment, imagine you having a mind that was completely absent of greed, hatred, and delusion. What would that be like? It's almost impossible to imagine. But I'm going to go into that in a little bit too. But that is what we're going to use as the definition of nirvana, the absence of those discursive emotions. So the Buddha said there are what he called fetters that keep us from achieving this state. They're subtle, and sometimes we don't even know they're going on. And there's 10 of them. And the very first one, which I think is the king of all the fetters, and really I think informs all the others, is our identification with the self. Self-identification, our ego, believing everything that is said about us, that we say about ourselves, that we say about other people and about other experiences, believing it all to be true. And we do that, and what does that do? It leads us down a really a path of suffering, because there is no permanent identity. All of you are changing identities constantly. So that's the first one, and I spoke about that a couple weeks ago. I'm going to go over it again in just a minute. But the other ones, the second one is doubt, which we're going to talk about tonight. The third one is clinging to rites and rituals, thinking that if you just do things a certain order, everything will be fine and you'll awaken.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you hope. And the fourth one is, what is the fourth one? Sensual desire. Of course, it's one of the three poisons. And the fifth one is ill will. These are the five lower fetters. And these are the ones we can see in our daily lives as we navigate what we're doing in life. Then there are the five higher fetters. And six and seven are a combination of pretty much being addicted to higher states of consciousness, the jhanas, and thinking you've arrived because you are able to achieve these higher states. The next one is conceit. It is said that conceit hangs on for a really long time, even after self-identity has gone. These feelings of conceit apparently happen even in people who are very, very well along the path. Restlessness, number nine, I love that. That people are restless all the way up to achieving awakening. And then the final one is ignorance. So in Orthodox Theravadan Buddhism, these are the stepping stones to awakening. Eliminating these are what takes us to awakening. So the first three, if you were to rid yourself completely of self-identity, doubt, and attachment to rites and rituals, you would be a stream enterer. And the Orthodox teachings. Stream enterer means that you are on your way and there's no turning back. And you will be reborn no more than 7 more times. You will also live in a very happy place while you're waiting to be reborn 7 more times. Very, very happy place. If you start attenuating the next two, then you will be a once returner, only coming back one more time. If you completely give up the first five, they no longer are knots in your psyche, you will be a non-returner. And if you accomplish all 10, you're an arhat, somebody who's completely awakened to achieve a completely blissful state till the end of eternity. So that's the traditional way of doing it. I got interested in the fetters more because I thought that they could be really useful in the prison setting, looking at these, especially self-identity. People in prison have identities that are constantly being reinforced. You're a criminal, you're no good, you'll never be any good, you're a throwaway. And they believe that, and then they take on other identities, gang identities, where they feel they have some power, prestige, that kind of thing. So I wanted to introduce self-identity to see if it was a way of breaking through all of that. And the way I did it, and I actually brought this to this group a couple of months ago, I said to a group of inmates, how do you respond if I look at you and just say, you're wrong? How do you respond to that? And the response was quite amazing. One guy said, by you saying that, you're pushing all my buttons. Another guy said, and it was kind of an intriguing moment, looked at me and said, you are asking me to give up all my power. He said, before I came in tonight, I had an argument with someone and I berated him so good. I made him feel so small. And he said, right now I can't stand myself, but that's what I need to do. So we started talking about that. And is Sangha a safe place to look at self-identity and what needs to be dropped to alleviate a lot of suffering in life? And you know, from the reports we've been getting, it looks like this is starting to take hold. People are really doing this in a place like this that's safe. That's a safe place to investigate identity. So is there any questions so far about fetters and self-identity? Yeah.
Just the one. I think I remember talking about uprooting. Once a fetter is uprooted, so if you really... that it never comes back?
That's my understanding. Okay. That's what I believe happens, yeah. And I believe that's when they say you enter, you're a stream enter, there's no going back. Those three fetters are uprooted.
There's another question.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, there seems to be some overlap with the hindrances, and mm-hmm. I don't know whether you work with them the same way or not, but I'm sure you're probably going to talk about it, but I'm curious about the fetters seem to have almost more of a, they're like bigger scope to me. But
you know, I haven't, yes, like doubt and ill will and sensuous desire, yes, you know, those are the hindrances as well, and they're in other lists as well. The Buddha often duplicated, and I think the reason...
Different context or something.
Yeah, who he was talking to, what was taking place. for me, and this is just for me, and I can only talk from my own experience and how I understand this, self-identity as the first fetter, to me, influences everything else, how you are experiencing everything else. So I'm taking it from that vantage point. I talked to Gil Fronsdale about this, who's one of my teachers, and he said, I think the fetters for prison is excellent and a good way of looking at self-identity. So I'm taking it from that vantage point. Every fetter after that is going to be looking at it from self-identity, the first one. Okay, so the second fetter is doubt. And as Linnell said, doubt is found on lots of lists. And there can be a skillful way of working with doubt and a very unskillful way of working with doubt. At least that's my experience. I have lots of experience with doubt. And I've been skillful sometimes and very unskillful sometimes. As Laura said 2 weeks ago, faith is absolutely necessary in Buddhist practice, and faith comes from doubt, investigating doubt. And faith, you know, just briefly to go into that, faith sometimes in our Western tradition has almost a negative connotation. Why is that? Anybody want to say, why does faith have a negative connotation in our society, at least for a lot of people? Any guesses?
The concept of blind faith, that you take from some authority to do things without examining them or mindlessly accepting the word of someone else.
Right. Yeah.
I was going to say basically the same thing. It doesn't, even if it doesn't fit your experience, you're supposed to believe it.
Exactly. That's right. And we've all seen the results of that, the fundamentalism of all faiths that just blindly accept what is told to them and cause so much havoc in the world. Not testing things out. In fact, I was just reading today in a book the way some people, fundamentalists, work with faith is they look for ways to prove what they already believe rather than being discriminatory about how does this work? Is this skillful? Yeah, Mama.
So, well, maybe it's just my interpretation, but faith, especially when I hear it used in this country, not Christian conservatives, people of faith is a divisive, it's very divisive. In other words, I'm a person of faith because of what I believe, and you in turn are not.
Right.
So I'm in a different.
But, you know, there are different people of faith. Jimmy Carter, the wonderful talk he gave and his fine with dying. He's lived a wonderful life and he plans on teaching Sunday school next week. He's a person of faith, but he has also investigated his faith. He no longer is a member of the Baptist Church because of their treatment of women and not allowing women to ordain or whatever they do in the Baptist Church. So he investigated and he found what was skillful for him and left the rest behind. So I think you're right, but I think we also need to be careful about who's talking. You know, how are they exhibiting this faith? So, doubt is discouraged in most mainstream religions. It doesn't happen. You're supposed to have faith. And I remember when I went to church as a youngster and I had some doubts about things. I mean, the usual things. Why does God let nice people die and suffer? And I remember the priest just saying, you just have to have faith. That's it. And just, even if you don't, pretend you do and faith will come. And I remember that advice, and that was kind of when it was like, this isn't making any sense.
And remember the how do you know? Well, the Bible says so.
Exactly. Exactly. The Bible says so. And that's all you need. That's
right.
Yeah, that's absolute faith. Joseph Goldstein said, certainty is not an indication of truth. I think that just sums it up very nicely. So in Buddhism, it's different. Everybody knows the Kalama Sutta, Kalama Sutra. Who doesn't know the Kalama Sutra? Raise your hand.
Remind me which one.
Okay, about half of you don't. The Kalama Sutra is probably one of the most famous sutras in Buddhism because it's the discourse where the Buddha describes how to skillfully doubt, how to look at your experience, and how to work with it. So I'm going to set it up, and then I'm just going to read two paragraphs because it's a fairly long sutra. But essentially, the Kalamas were a group of people who had all sorts of visiting dignitaries and ascetics and spiritual people, and they would come and say to them, this is what you should be believing, and all else is not true. And they'd go, okay. And then the next group would come in and say, no, they're wrong. This is what you should be believing, and all else is not true. They go, okay. And then the next group would come in. So the Buddha shows up. And at this point, they're really, really confused. What do we believe? What do we want to practice? So this is just a short rendition of this. I'm just reading two paragraphs of it. As they sat there, the Kalamas of Kesaputta said to the Blessed One, Lord, there are some Brahmins and contemplatives who come to Kesaputta. They expound and glorify their own doctrines, but as for the doctrines of others, they deprecate them. They revile them. They show contempt for them and disparage them. And then other Brahmins and contemplatives come to Kesaputta. They expound and glorify their own doctrines, and they disparage others. They leave us absolutely uncertain and in doubt. Which of these venerable Brahmins and contemplatives are speaking the truth, and which ones are lying? It's a good question. It's a very good question. And the Buddha answers, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you're in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by thought. This contemplative is our teacher. When you know that for yourselves, that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities when adopted and carried out lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And then he goes on to say, if these teachers act skillfully, they do not talk with greed, hatred, or delusion. They should be listened to. They are the wise. So the Buddha is saying, test it. Test it for yourself. Ayipasiko means try it out for yourself. So this is where Buddhism is pretty different from most other traditions. This doubt, this skillful doubt, is encouraged. This is what leads to faith. In fact, it's essential for faith in this practice. There's a cute little story about some fish. And these fish are in a pond. And one of the fish jumps out. And all of a sudden, he's not in his watery world anymore. And he's out where there's sun and there's air and all this is happening. And he cannot believe what's taking place. He flips back in the water and tries to tell all the other fish what's going on. And they're going, you're out of your mind. You're totally crazy. That is not possible. And that's kind of where we are. We have faith when maybe we flipped out of the water for a little bit and saw something else. And then we can have more faith as the teachings start coming to pass, things that we might not have known, but through our practice, we start knowing them. So Thich Nhat Hanh said, do not be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. And the Buddha said that too. Don't even cling to this. That's not freedom either. It's kind of a hard concept to get, but get it. Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means. They are not absolute truth. Do not think the knowledge you presently possess is changeless. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to receive others' viewpoints. Truth is found in life and not merely in conceptual knowledge. Be ready to learn throughout your entire life and to observe reality in yourself and in the world at all times. That's quite a lesson. But that's what we need to do, even clinging to these Buddhist ideals which guide us along the path, but they are not the path. This is why the sixth and seventh of the fetters is not clinging to these jhanic states, these states of mind, elevated states of mind, which a lot of people would think, well, I've arrived, I'm awakened, look at me. That's not it either. It's still not freedom. It's still self-identity. So I just read a book, and it's about Ramana Maharishi. Has anybody heard of Ramana Maharishi? A couple people? Okay. It's considered the last great Indian sage. And I read it because I've been researching different teachings on looking at self-identity, the first fetter, and how to do it. And the way he said to do it was, when you're meditating or in your everyday life, you are constantly asking, who am I? Who am I? I've been doing this, and it's a very interesting practice because you just see how many identities you have and how attached to some of them you are and some others not so much. It's really, really interesting. So, and he said the second thing that everybody needs to do is spend a great deal of time in solitude asking this question, who am I? So in the book that was written by a Mr. Cohen, and he is quite a devotee of the Maharishi, and was so taken with him and his teachings, he decided to give up everything. He gave up his family, he gave up his ties, I believe he was from England, and he went to India, and he went to the Maharishi and said, I am so convinced by you that I've given up everything, and I just want to be with you and learn everything I possibly can. And the Maharishi said, so you've broken all ties with your family and former life. Your firm conviction brought you here, but where is the room for doubt? Can you see this is the same thing that Thich Nhat Hanh just said? If you have absolutely established this is the way it is, there's no growth. There's no awakening. There's no letting go. You just stay there. So Maharishi there was talking about skillful doubt. And the Buddha said we should be experiencing doubt and working with it until we are completely enlightened. You know, everybody here, okay, the Handful of Leaves Sutta, has everybody heard of that one? Okay, who hasn't? Raise your hand. As soon as I say it, you'll have heard it, I'm sure. And this is a very short sutta. And again, it's about leaving open doubt and leaving open the possibility. Don't be so sure of everything. Doubt. So the Blessed One was living at Kosambi in a wood of Simsapa trees. He picked up a few leaves in his hand and he asked the bhikkhus, how do you conceive this, bhikkhus? Which is more, the few leaves that I've picked up in my hand or those on the trees in the wood? The leaves that the Blessed One has picked up in his hand are few, Lord. Those in the wood are far more. So too, Bhikkhus, the things that I have known by direct knowledge are more. The things that I have told you are only a few. Why have I not told them to you? Because they bring no benefit, no advancement in the holy life, and because they do not lead to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing. That is why I have not told them. And what have I told you? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. That is why what I have told you. Why have I told you that? Because it brings benefit and advancement in the holy life, and because it leads to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. So, you know, what we see right here, just like the fish, you know, the other fish couldn't even imagine it until we experience it ourselves. But he has given us a path to start following. Not clinging to the path, but a path to start following. So, working with doubt unskillfully, I think, is the second better. I think that is having this identity of I can't do it, an identity of doubt. Ajahn Buddhadasa was a very famous Thai meditation teacher. He died in, somebody told me last time I brought him up, I think it was Ryan, wasn't you? Well, maybe it wasn't you, but anyway, somebody told me, I think it was 1990 or something like that. Ayasanta Chitta, this was her first teacher. And I was looking up what he had to say about doubt. And he said it is the cause of wavering and uncertainty, unskillful doubt. Now we're talking about working with it unskillfully. And he called it suffering doubt. So this isn't doubt that we can use to gain knowledge and wisdom. It's what just keeps us immersed in a state of mind that keeps us suffering. Can you see the difference between the two? Exploration versus mired in a state of mind and not moving anywhere. So he called it suffering doubt. And he listed some of the aspects of suffering doubt. And he said it's due to a variety of factors, which include inadequate knowledge and or experience. Okay. I think a lot of us can relate to this, and I know when I teach beginning meditation or in the prison, people will say, well, you know, I've been sitting and meditating for 4 weeks, and I come here every week, and I don't see any difference. This doesn't work. And this happens a lot. People say, I just don't see a difference. When am I going to see a difference? So there's two hang-ups there. First of all, they are trying to undo a lifetime of suffering, you know, in a couple of weeks. And secondly, they're holding a goal out here. Like, you know, here it is. This is what I need bliss. I need happiness. Why is it happening right now? Doubt about what this subject is really about. As I just said, I want pleasant results. In prison, many of the prisoners have said, well, I'm here because I want to levitate. I want to levitate out of here. We actually, on the back of our service booklet, it's included as one of the questions for volunteers to be able to answer. When they're hoping that's what will take place, or at least be blissed out enough to not being bothered by being in prison. Doubt about a teacher. Doubt about a teacher. And thinking that this is the entire path, because one particular teacher perhaps said something you don't agree with, or that wasn't your experience, and then you just say, that's it. This path doesn't work. He goes on, doubt as to whether this practice for breaking free from suffering is really the right thing for everyone. I have this doubt. I'll admit it. I do have this doubt. I don't know if it is for everyone with people's various mind states. I think people who are, in my own opinion, in deep trauma, maybe this isn't the path for them. People who need a black and white situation and not the nuance that is Buddhism, this might not be the path for them. My own opinion, and from my own experience in dealing with a variety of different people. And then doubt whether the Buddha, did he really attain enlightenment? Who is this guy? Is he real? Is he a figment of somebody's imagination? You know? And then the big one that I started out with, self-identification is liberation for me. I don't think I can do this. This is too hard. It's not in the cards for me. This is being mired in doubt. And the really interesting thing about that is, no matter what you think, you're right. If you think you can be liberated, you will be. And if you don't think you can, you won't be. It's all in your mind and your mental state and how much you want to practice and how much you want to be free. So here's another story. It's about taking advantage of what's in front of you or not. So it's called the Wishing Tree. It's about this guy. He's very poor. He's wandering through the woods. Doesn't have any job. He's unhappy. He's just walking around. And finally he decides that he's going to stop and sit under a tree and rest. What he doesn't know is this is a wishing tree. And as he's sitting there, he says, boy, I am thirsty. I wish I had a glass of water. And a glass of water appears on his side. He looks around, wondering if somebody put it there, but they didn't. So he drinks the water and then says, you know, I would love a good meal. I'm really hungry and I have no money. And all of a sudden, this beautiful meal appears right in front of him. And now he's really intrigued. And he said, okay, I wish for a really nice house. And he looks across the meadow, and there is this beautiful house appears. And then he says, and I want servants in the house. And all of a sudden these servants appear, and they're walking towards him. And he said, to make everything perfect, then I want a beautiful, wise wife who will be my partner for life. And a beautiful woman appears and brings him much joy. And then he says, wait a minute. These kind of things don't happen for me. Everything disappeared. And he said, I knew it. And that's the way we are, if we doubt our ability to wake up. The Buddha said every one of us is capable of waking up. If we weren't, he said, I wouldn't be teaching what I'm teaching you. So that self-identity that some of you might have, and I know I've certainly had it, it's not true. And I'm going to give some ideas on how to work with that in a minute. So how to work with this aspect of doubt? Well, one thing is, as I just said, if you have this overriding feeling of doubt, you need to investigate it like you would any other mental state. It had a cause. There's something, remember last week Dennis was saying that everything is cause and effect. Something happened before. What happened before that caused this doubt? It didn't just all of a sudden appear. What was it? And you can investigate it skillfully using mindfulness and clear comprehension. You know, was it a sitting that you had? And the sitting was just, you know, not good. Sometimes we have sittings that just are not good. And you're restless and you just can't wait to get up. And then you die. I can't do this. Was it that? Or was it a Dharma talk? Maybe this talk that causes doubt? What was it exactly that's taking place? And how does it feel in the mind and body? Break it down just like you would any other mental state. So, if you have doubt about practice, investigate it carefully. And if you had doubt about a teacher, and you know, we all can think of many examples, unfortunately, in all traditions where teachers have taken advantage of students, they have been more interested in their own power, money, prestige, than they are in Dharma. And, you know, there's just too many stories of students walking away because of what took place. So in that case, you investigate the teacher. Are they ethically inclined? Are they living what they talk about when they give Dharma talks? Or is it just talk and as soon as they leave, you know, there's somebody else? Are they following the path themselves? Another way of looking at doubt, and I think this is the one I emphasize in most of the classes I teach, is every one of us has had awakening moments. Unfortunately, most of us walk by those awakening moments. We pay no attention to them. They're just blips. I think I mentioned once when I had a practice interview with John Travis, he said, after I was talking, he said, you know what, you've talked about all this joy that took place, but you spent two-thirds of the time talking about all the negative stuff. He goes, what happened to the good stuff? Did you notice it? Did you pay attention? Do you elevate that? Do you allow that to increase because you are paying attention? No, he's looking for the negative stuff. More interesting, I guess. I don't know. So think of a time when you have been at ease, when your mind has been at ease. What is taking place there? The more you start noticing, the more it's going to happen. And that will be your experience that takes care of so much doubt. So I'm reading a book right now by Stephen Batchelor. Stephen Batchelor wrote Confessions of an Atheist Buddhist. I think that was the name of it. And this book was written way, way before he became a secularist. It was written right after he spent some time in a Korean monastery. It's called The Faith to Doubt. The Faith to Doubt. And the title alone got me interested in it. And it comes from a Mahayana perspective, although he states that a 10-day Goenka retreat really took his practice to another level. And he decided to do a 3-month Korean Zen retreat where investigation of doubt is the primary practice. In fact, he said the three practices were great faith, great doubt, and great courage. And they lived by the Chinese proverb, great doubt, great enlightenment. Little doubt, little enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment. So in our tradition, if people have been practicing for many, many, many years, they often have what is called the dark night of the soul. I don't know if it's often or not. I know it's been written about, and I certainly experienced it at one time. And it's when you really, really doubt the practice. And the reason you doubt it is because of all the practice that takes place, that self-identity starts to slip now and then. And when that happens, there's no ground that you're used to. And it can be terrifying. Called the Dark Night of the Soul, which was coined by St. John of the Cross as he went through, you know, something very, very similar. Yet, this is the time that practice can be elevated to, if you don't walk away from it. When I talked to Gil about this, he said, this is the time you need to do a month-long retreat. You need to investigate this completely. This is a very valuable experience. It's a valuable doubt. And for any of you who go through that, don't walk away from it. Stay with it. Investigate it to the best of your ability. This is to quote Stephen Batchelor when he was going through this at this Korean monastery. In other words, the deepest doubts or questions you have about existence are the key, which if turned correctly and with right effort, can open a door to response. So use doubt skillfully. Investigate it. If it's there, good. Good, that's great. It means you're thinking. It means you're experiencing this path for yourself. You can investigate it. But don't get so mired down with it that you start self-identifying with it and saying, this is me. This is me, and there's no way out. So are there any questions on this? Any comments?
Well, I had a question. I always thought that failure was that you doubt one doubted, and if you the doubt went away, then failure wasn't there. But are you saying that actually there's distinction between skillful doubt and unskillful doubt, and if you have doubt but you're working with it skillfully, it's not that the second failure of doubt isn't there?
That's my understanding of, at least my experience, because the Buddha talks, like I had mentioned in the Kalama Sutta, you know, how important doubt is, yet it's a fetter. So I'm assuming that you can have skillful doubt, like the Kalamas did, and he gave instructions on how to work with that. And then as Ajahn Buddhadasa talked about suffering doubt, which I believe would be the second fetter, the kind of thing we have to drop. That's my explanation, and that's all it is.
You can have both.
That's my experience, and I believe so only because of what I just said to Bob. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else anything?
Yeah. Self-identifying or disidentifying self, and stream entry. Is there like a certain degree or level? I mean, like all thoughts have, you know, that person is disidentified with all thoughts, or at times they have disidentified with thoughts, but then there are times when they get brought back in with thoughts. I mean, what exactly?
Yeah. I don't think it has so much to do with thoughts as with identification with those thoughts. Thoughts are going to happen, but the thoughts that you believe, this is me, this is who I am, the I, me, and mine, I believe that's when this fetter really causes problems. And it causes problems for all of us all the time because we do believe that. That's why I mentioned the Maharishi who said, always ask, who am I? You know, what's going on? And, thoughts are going to happen. Awakened people, I'm sure, enlightened people have thoughts. It's just that they don't cling to them any longer. They don't have to believe they're true. They can let that go, including thoughts about themselves. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Brian.
I like your comment about this may not be for all mind states or for all people. My experience, for me, my identity disorders, like by the DSM, whatever, 17 now, whatever it's up to, trying to establish a healthy identity and then coming into this practice, it's really a mind-blowing thing. And for me, if I don't have all the tools of the Buddhist practice, including Sangha to come back to, I'm in trouble. And I'm alone with my thoughts, and that's not a very good place to be. And I know like the VA is trying to teach mindfulness and great trauma. And these guys are left for 30 days, you know, to sit in their trauma by themselves. And so like if the whole package isn't together, this can be a very dangerous, for me anyway, my experience. I'm opening up all this stuff that I've been trying to suppress for all these years. And so I appreciate that. I can just imagine an inmate sitting in his cell with his thoughts, you know, uncovering whatever.
Well, this was one of the topics that was brought up at this retreat, how to deal with trauma that comes from meditation. So I think you described it right. If all circumstances are optimal, great. You know, give it a try. But so often circumstances are not optimal. And then what do you do? So, yeah, I agree with you.
Well, sort of that kind of made me think about it. The practice of learning that you're not your thoughts has been life-changing for me. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what the thoughts I had identified with were very mean. I mean, just mean.
Yeah.
And I believed all of them, and it's taken me, you know, years and years to kind of be able to see that the difference. And all the time you're talking, I'm thinking, it's the difference between conceptualizing what this is, this person in here that's like this and like that and all that, and learning how to kind of be a little, you know, like maybe smell the rat a little bit when the mind starts giving those kind of little those messages about whatever it is, whether, gee, this is really good, I need to go for it, or, oh, this is really a terror. Just to start to really tease that out as a thing that isn't me.
Right. That's right. Then you're investigating.
And that, then you're of necessity into the experience of whatever that thing is. And it's just a completely different thing.
Exactly. Yes.
But the thing that I'm learning is that those old habits can still be pretty toxic, and you can fall down, and it takes a while to remember, oh, wait a minute, that's one of those things I should be investigating. And it can get a little dicey. So yes, I too think of the prisoners, and when you talk about what they are able to express and talk about how honest they are, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's really hard.
Yep. Well, it's hard for all of us, but especially in a very challenging environment.
I mean, in their whole life long hearing those messages.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So I think you said this, but I want to make sure I understood it. So the doubt that arises from certainty is to be abandoned, whereas doubt that arises from uncertainty, okay, is to be investigated.
That's a great way of putting it.
That was
perfect.
Yeah.
Seems like a good guideline.
It's a very good guideline, and it's very succinct. I think that's excellent.
Say it again.
Write it down.
The doubt that arises from certainty is to be abandoned, whereas doubt that arises from uncertainty is to be investigated.
Really good. Yes. Thank you, Everett. That was great. Anybody else? Yes.
Question. So regarding the self-identity, okay, let's say, for example, I feel I'm suffering. Let's say, for example, I feel I have trauma. Is that part of self-identity?
Feeling you have, yes, it is. It is self-identity, but it's also something that is been experienced. So, you know, so many people who have gone through trauma, deep trauma, I believe, really need to see maybe therapists or some other professionals before undertaking this practice, because that is part of their psyche. It's called spiritual bypassing. If you think, I can just take this whole traumatic experience that I've had and I'll just start meditating and everything will be fine, it's not. I mean, it's not to say it always is not. Sometimes it works, but I wouldn't take a chance on it. You know, if I had some deep-seated trauma, that is part of my self-identity. It's part of my experience, and it needs to be dealt with. That answer, kind of?
So let's say, for example, I have a coworker. He mentioned to me his job is very complex. Mm-hmm. He needs to be very concentrated to solve a technical problem. Okay. But he just cannot concentrate. So he told to me he's very struggling because he cannot concentrate. Mm-hmm. So he cannot solve the technical problem very well. So he had been challenged all the time because of technical work he's doing. Mm-hmm. So he feels he's been suffering because he cannot concentrate. Mm-hmm. So he cannot solve properly. He cannot analyze the technical problem very, very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. That required in his job. So he feels he's in suffering.
Right. And I'm sure he is. But if he thought, well, I'll take up meditation so I can concentrate, it's not a quick fix. It's just like Ajahn Buddha Dasa said, people think, okay, I'm going to solve this. I'm just going to start doing this. It's taken a long time to get to that place. It's going to take quite a while to get out of that place.
So what's your recommendation? Because he spoke to me, okay, he just cannot concentrate. Yeah. Okay, but his job requires concentration because he's on a very high level of technical position. Okay, so because of that position, that requires he needs to working up very difficult technical problem. He just cannot do it.
I would tell him to start taking a meditation course, you know, and at least start on the path and do what he can. And it's you have to start someplace. So that would be my recommendation for him.
Or do you think that his friend is having that trauma or the difficulties because of the different personal life experience or where it was going in his life?
Would you say that again?
So do you think that you're suggesting that he should take some meditation courses?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he is where he is right now because of the different problem in his life? Difficulties, struggles, stress, or any kind of personal problem, issues he's been having last whatever years?
Yeah. All I'm going by is exactly what he said. He's having trouble concentrating at work with some technical issues. That's all I know, and I know meditation helps with concentration. Not immediately, but it will definitely help. So he didn't mention anything else, and so I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your understanding about trauma and needing to, you know, sort of tread carefully. I appreciate what Brian shared. I have really strong trauma history as well, and I've been here and then left and come back and left because what I found is with trauma, a history of trauma, you really have to, I think what I sort of come and see that as like Buddhism light. Like if I keep it sort of the Tara Brach, you know, reading books about self-acceptance, and you know, there's a lot of really great stuff that has helped me immensely about the practice. But if I know that I'm not at all ready for like some of the deeper more philosophical aspects of Buddhism, and I have the kind of mind that can really obsess about it and become really
suffering.
So yeah, I think it's really important that the teachers understand that about trauma. You know, you really do have to, and I think often if you're working with a therapist, it makes it a lot safer as well. But yeah, you have to have a really strong identity before you can start working on not having one.
Yeah. To know the self is to give the self up, kind of thing. This was a huge topic at a community Dharma leadership training because trauma can be so devastating. And we were told people will try to spiritually bypass it, mm-hmm. thinking this will happen, when actually it just will bring trauma up. You know, and we're not psychiatrists, we're not therapists. We're not skilled in dealing with that. They need to see professionals to deal with these deep-rooted issues. So we're spiritual advisors, and that's it. Okay, well, I've gone 2 minutes past my deadline. I'm very sorry to have kept you all so late. And let's just do a final closing metta. So may you all be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. May you be peaceful and happy and healthy and strong. May you work skillfully with doubt as it comes up, knowing how to incorporate it as a practice, to elevate your own practice and realign your pathway to complete awakening. May you be free in this lifetime. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.